You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me as always is my co-host Matthew Rushing. But this week, not only is Matthew with me, but for the first time, we have a third voice on the panel. And it's a very special one. It is none other than Dr. Una McCormick, who you all know as a Star Trek author, author of many Deep Space Nine books, and Una is also a lecturer in creative writing at the Anglia Ruskin University in Cambridge. Una, welcome to The Orb.
Hello, guys. It's very nice to be here.
So glad to have you.
It's great to have you.
Thank you. Thank you. It's very late here, but I'm pushing through.
Well, we really appreciate it.
Right. Yeah, I was going to say it's very late for you. Unfortunately, we don't have 26 hours in a day like they do on Bajor, so we're cutting it right at the end of your day.
We are, yes. I'll be fine. I can stay up late to talk about Garak.
I know he's your favorite character.
Yeah, definitely.
Definitely. And that is why you're joining us today to talk about Garak. Now, is he a tailor or is he a spy? We don't really know. Is he an outcast? Or is he a spy? Or is he an outcast spy?
Oh, well, he's all these things, isn't he? He's all these things at once. He contains multitudes, does our man Garak, I think. He's every one of these is a little bit of the truth, and every one of these is a little bit of a lie, I think. Yeah, so all of this makes up Garak.
You know, that's one of my favorite moments, early moments of Garak, is in The Wire at the end when Bashir asks him, what's true, you know, the truths or the lies? And he says, oh, it's all true, especially the lies.
Especially the lies. Absolutely.
That just sums up Garak so perfectly.
It's pure Garak. If you take what I'm saying literally, you're a fool. But if you're listening to the actual what's going on behind here and the subtext and the story, I'm telling you everything that you need to know. You just need to pay attention. Yeah, very, very Garak. I love that bit as well. Yeah.
Yeah, I love the fact that with Garak, as you watch throughout the show, you end up having to just kind of look for and sift and kind of decode. And every once in a while, he'll tell similar stories to which you can pick up on all the little things that are similar in them. So you can kind of figure out what he's saying that is true and what's mm-hmm. just part of a story that he's creating. And it makes for such an interesting character. And I think what I really liked about Garak, especially in the first season, is that the moment he came on screen, you knew that this was going to be a different series because they were giving you a character that you couldn't pin down. And, you know, most of the alien characters from TOS or TNG, most of them are very kind of cut and dry. You know, you're going to know they're the bad guy. You're going to know they're the good guy. But Garak, especially for most of the series, you are not sure who or what he really is.
Yeah, and yet despite that, when you watch the pattern and you kind of, you know, there's a lot of mystery about him, certainly a lot of mystery about the reason for his exile, whether indeed he is exiled or not, whether he's a tailor, whether he's a spy, there's all that mystery there. And yet really, his motivation is always very, very simple, which is that he loves Cardassia and he's doing what he thinks is best for Cardassia. That's a little bit more complicated, of course, the way it plays out, because Cardassia and Tane are the same thing in his mind, and so that gets a bit more complicated. But really, his motivation is that simple. If it's good for Cardassia, if I think it's good for Cardassia, I'll do it. It takes him down some interesting byways, but for a complex man, I think that motivation runs very deep, and it's quite uncomplicated in a way. He loves his homeland. You know, he misses it. He loves to see it when he gets back. So there's a strange simplicity to him at the same time behind all the complicated lies and top-level stuff that's going on.
So, Una, that's a good point to bring us to his background, which is, I think, something I wanted to talk about early on. You talk about how he does love Cardassia, which I think becomes clearer, yeah, as you see the things that he does. How do you see his background as a member of the Obsidian Order shaping that, as well as shaping the character who we see when he walks up to Bashir for that first time?
I think the Obsidian Order must, certainly the way I read it, it seems to give Garak a defined place in Cardassian society. We know, I think, that Cardassia puts a great deal of emphasis on the family. We know that Garak is illegitimate. And do we know as well that illegitimate children are basically dead or alive at the whims of their parents? And so I think that the Obsidian Order gives Garak something concrete to hang on to. And if you're going to have an organisation like that, you're always going to fill it with people who are basically vulnerable. They want to feel that they have a source of power. And so you fill it up with people like that who are perhaps a bit marginal or on the outside. And he thrives in that environment. Clearly, he triumphs. So it helps that he's got a powerful patron. But I don't think that Tane would hesitate. Well, we know that Tane wouldn't hesitate to dispose of Garak the minute that it becomes inconvenient for him. So I think the Obsidian Order is critical in allowing Garak to have some kind of function and position in Cardassian society and allow him to feel like he's contributing in a way that he can't, in the way that other members of that society do. Absolutely crucial, yeah.
Well, and it really gives Garak, too, because of that very strange and dysfunctional father-son relationship, he's also always trying to prove himself to his father that he's good enough. And so everything he does is really wrapped up in that. And you see that when he joins Tane on their maniacal quest to destroy the Founder's homeworld because he wants nothing more to please his father. And, you know, you get to that episode and Garak has lost his step when it comes to torture and things like this. It doesn't please him anymore because there's something in him that's, you know, growing and changing as a character. He's no longer just beholden to his father and trying to please him. He's learned to, in some ways, become his own man.
Yeah, it costs Garak to do that interrogation of Odo, I think. You really see that. I mean, obviously it's costing Odo more because he's the victim, the subject of it. But yes, you can see that this is not something that he would have relished in the past. He's not relishing it here, and that presumably is too much contact with the Federation, too much time with Bashir. I don't know. Yeah, so that really does cost him. Yeah.
Well, and it also, you know, you watch and you what we learn about his early life in the Obsidian Order. I think you really see how that training has paid off to keep him alive. It does such a good job of him, you know, being able to get away from Tane in the first place. So he isn't killed then. And obviously, Tane wants him in exile. He wants him to live a very long time and to suffer for what he's done.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. There's a wonderful father figure, Tane. For any of those looking for father figures, look up to, he's the one. But, you know, it also it helps him when he first gets to Tarak Nor. And, you know, he's been responsible for Dukat's father's death, and he's able to keep himself alive until the occupation ends, and then he's able to set up his shop. And this ability to always stay one step ahead of people is something that keeps him, you know, by the time we get to the fact that it's actually Deep Space Nine and he's there as the tailor.
And to present as non-threatening, I think, as well, to sort of, you know, it's all smiles, welcome to the shop, let's have a cup of tea together, all of this. He presents as non-threatening, and yet at the same time, particularly thinking of that first meeting with Bashir, presents as deeply, deeply sinister. It's absolutely great. You know, the way he just creeps up on Bashir and comes up behind him, a hand on the shoulder and everything. No, nothing to worry about, nothing to worry about. At the same time, you know that there's somebody here who, if he doesn't mean you well, you're in trouble. So it's great. I guess that's protecting himself as well, sending out these vibes just to make it clear to people that he's not going to be a soft touch. He's not going to be someone that they can destroy easily. So very complicated. Yeah, and I imagine that the what he did in the Obsidian Order involved just sliding into different roles all the time, to the extent he I imagine at some point he hardly knew what the real self was anymore. Yeah.
Yeah, you see him doing things. Well, in that episode, he helps them uncover the plot, and he lets Bashir hear what the Duras sisters are up to. He does so many things where you're never quite sure if he's doing them for Starfleet to help Sisko and his crew, if he's doing them for Cardassia, if he's doing them for himself, what his end goal is.
Mm.
Maybe it is hard to tell if he has his own complete identity, as we're saying here, or if exactly what's going on in his mind.
Do you think at that early stage it's partly that he's he really doesn't know what's going on? He's got this new situation that's happening. The Federation arrived, everything's all changed. Who is going to be on my side, he's probably thinking. I've got to test out these new guys. I've got to find out where the weak link is. Oh, it's probably that doctor. He looks like he doesn't have a clue. I'll go and buy him a cup of tea and see what I can get out of him. That captain, he looks interesting. There might be some sport with him later on. So I think in those early days, particularly those maybe the first couple of seasons where we see him, Garak is at sea as well. He doesn't really know. Perhaps he doesn't know why he's been left behind. It must still be incredibly puzzling and unsettling for him as well. So that may be why we get these kind of mixed signals from him, I think.
Well, and having gone through everything that he's gone through, I think that you touched on the fact that you do kind of have an identity crisis after being so many different people for so long. I mean, you know, he's been to Romulus, he's been on so many different missions, he's been doing all he can to live up and please this father figure that he's can never please. Talk about a warped sense of identity. And so by the time the Federation gets there, in some ways, I'm not sure if he even knows what to do with himself, because this is completely different. And I don't think he ever thought he'd be involved with the Federation of all things. And, you know, it's interesting, I think, to watch, because as swarmy as he is towards everyone and giving them that kind of creepy vibe, at the same time, it does always feel like to me that he really is reaching out, looking for somebody to be true to him for the first time in his life. And, you know, when that finally happens, you know, he just happens to pick the right person for that to happen with, which is Bashir, giving him that opportunity to become a person that has his own identity that isn't as much wrapped up in everything else. That is a hugely interesting thing. And again, you know, that relationship just lets you know that this is going to be a different type of show. We're going to get really deep with the characters, and we're going to explore some psychological places that we have never explored on Star Trek before.
Yeah, I completely agree with that. I think Bashir, although perhaps Garak goes in thinking, oh, this is going to be easy, I can manipulate this guy, I think that Bashir does work this change on Garak that Garak completely isn't anticipating, so that by the time it comes to having to do things like torture Odo, he's not got the taste for this anymore. He's seen a glimpse of a different way of life. And as his exile rolls on, you know, it's 3 years, it's 4 years, five, six, he realizes he really quite likes tailoring. You know, he must start to think, am I ever going to go back? Am I just stuck here? What will I do if I am stuck here? This could go on 10 years, 20 years. I could still be tailoring at the end of this. At some point, he's probably thinking, maybe I'm going to have to give in to this and stay here. I actually quite like it here on Deep Space Nine. And I think you're right that Bashir is absolutely pivotal, absolutely crucial to that friendship. Makes strange changes at Garak, I think.
And if nothing else, all the skills that he gains by tailoring for so many years, if he does go back to Cardassia, he's going to be perfect for the leadership of the Obsidian Tailors.
Yeah, exactly. He'll never want for work. Yes. Even with the Obsidian Order gone, he's still got a trade.
That is the evilest organization ever, the Obsidian Tailors. Man, they make the Tal Shiar look like...
To make... The power to make uniforms uncomfortable. I think that's a really great power, actually. Yeah, that could bring a military to its knees.
I think he specializes, though, in admiral's uniforms for Starfleet. You know, really give him the big shoulder pads and the big belt buckles.
Yeah. And I think he does all the kind of off-duty stuff that the Federation people are wearing. And they're too frightened of him to say, look, this just looks terrible. Please don't put me in those wrap-over shirts anymore. But no, they don't say to Garrick, oh, no, it looks great. Thanks very much.
Oh, man. While we're talking about relationships, so Bashir was definitely the person, I think, that kind of opened the door for Garrick to develop on the station. But later, he gets into this relationship with Zial, and I thought that was a very fascinating turn by the writers to put them together. And what were your thoughts on how Zial influenced Garrick himself?
Well, I think it's a really interesting character to put in there. I mean, she's patently far too young for him. It's, there's a good 30 years between them.
Right.
And I think it's a shame that it kind of arises from I think arises from an unease that the writers were having with showing Garrick and Bashir together, and there's lots of homoerotic subtext. I think they're quite uncomfortable with that. So you do get a sense of Zial being kind of shunted in to kind of diffuse that, which is a pity, I think. But at the same time, it's I think it's a really interesting relationship. I think she has a great effect on him. She's a pretty great character, actually, Zial. It's a shame she's not consistently played through the show, or that, you know, she goes through so many changes. You've got this young girl who's grown up in a prison camp, has had a really tough life, and has got a certain amount of steel about her. And I think she's prepared to call Garrick when he's messing her around or patronizing her. She's pretty sturdy. He's genuinely afraid that, you know, she might be after his blood. But I think she's got a kind of this steeliness in her that she doesn't blink when he doesn't blink. Mm-hmm. So I think she's actually quite a good match for him in many ways. I think if she'd survived, they could well have married. And possibly I think that would have satisfied a craving in Garrick for family, which is such an important part of Cardassian culture and society. I think they could have had quite a successful marriage, but alas, we don't see that. I think her her absence is a great changes him in certain ways. That there's a kind of incorruptibility about her that he feels he has to honour in some way. I don't know how much we get to see that on the show, but certainly I feel that in the way Andy Robinson is playing it from then on. I think she's an interesting character. Yeah.
Yeah. That was the other part of the question, was how do you feel, even though we don't get to see it maybe as much as we would like on screen, after she does die, how do you personally feel, again, from a psychological standpoint, that affects Garrick moving forward through the rest of his life, and of course, the events that we do see him go through with his crewmates during the war and such?
I think it's a devastating loss to him. I think it really is. I think she symbolises something about Cardassia that he wants to fight for after Tane is dead. Once Tane is gone, it's like, you know, the planks of his world fall out. But Zial almost gives him something to live for that is Cardassian, a kind of a Cardassia where she can live as a half Cardassian, half Bajoran person, a kind of improved, better Cardassia. So when she dies, I do think that's a devastating blow. I think he continues to want to fight for that Cardassia. And I think the other thing that it probably does, which is crucial for later in the show, is it probably brings him closer to Kira. We just see a glimpse of this at the where they're standing together over Zial's body. We see this moment of really quite a tender exchange between Garrick and Kira, which I think is the first time we see that, where Kira doesn't speak with open hostility and Garrick isn't trying to wind her up. That's the first time we see them speak to each other as people speaking to each other. So I think that's very important, obviously very important for later on when they're stuck together and having to work together. So I think Zial is pretty crucial to the way Garrick evolves, the way he changes. Yeah.
And I think one of the things, too, that I really love about what Zial does for Garrick is, Garrick is a person who has spent his life thinking that he has to earn people's love and respect. And that is a hugely damaging psychological issue to have in your life, to always feel that you are someone who needs to earn people's respect. You have to earn their love. You can't just be given it freely, especially, you know, when that comes from your parent. And kind of struggling with those kind of issues myself, I really relate to Garrick in that. And so when Zial comes to him and just accepts him for who he is, and not only that, but he knows that she loves him. And he doesn't know why, because he in himself doesn't feel he deserves it. But that's the beauty of her love for him. It's a free gift. And in that way, in a lot of ways, it's very redemptive for Garrick. And I think the moment that she comes on the station and that their relationship begins to blossom, and like you said, Una, it's not always, you know, they had a lot of problems trying to get the right actress, and they had background issues because of that. And, you know, that happened. But I think just what the character did for him was hugely important. And it made it all the worse, you know, when Dumar kills her. And you know that Garrick is going to come back and she's going to be gone. And he doesn't show it per se as much as another character might, but you know that his heart has been crushed.
Yeah.
Because what he, I think, saw in her was the ability to have a Cardassia that was going to be different. And now what drives him after her death, I think, like you said, is to fight for a Cardassia that would have accepted her. And that would have been good enough for her. And I love the fact that this very, you know, at the beginning, minor character becomes somebody with such depth that I can have this. I mean, I personally, sorry, talking about him, I'm kind of having an emotional reaction because it's a very personal subject, but it's very real. And this, I think, again, is just the strength of where the writers took these characters and not being afraid to really plumb the depths of emotion and what that does to us.
I completely agree with you. It's amazing what they do with these very, very, I mean, Garrick's in about 30 episodes, I think, but Zial may be in, oh, I don't know, 7 or 8. I completely agree with you about that redemptive love aspect. I think it comes as a real shock to him. What, you love me? You like me? You know, let's go back just to that bit. It's completely transformative for that. Yeah, I completely agree with you, Matty. Spot on.
And like you said, Garrick is in, it's not that many episodes of DS9, although it feels like he's always there. And there are a lot of DS9 fans who, you can ask them, who is your favorite character? And they will say Garrick, a character who's not part of the main cast, but he has developed in such a rich way, as we see here.
Well, in my mind, this is a program about Garrick. That's pretty much how I see Deep Space Nine. It's like Star Trek, the Garrick show. And then there's like all this other stuff going on. Oh, yeah, we've got an episode about Bajor, and there's some stuff happening about the Trill. We can skip
where's
through
Garrick?
All that. You know, where's Garrick? What's going on? What's happening here? That's pretty much how I read Deep Space Nine. It's actually the Garrick show, and I'm just not getting the right episodes. You know, they're showing me all these other episodes that they've made for some strange reason. So it feels like he's there all the time. You watch episodes thinking, oh, I wonder what Garrick's thinking about that, or I wonder what he's doing behind the scenes that we can't quite see. I'm convinced, for example, that he's in the episode where we discover that Bashir is genetically enhanced, the one with the holographic doctor. I'm convinced that Garrick is in that episode. He's not, but for some reason, I just have him. I just have scenes in my mind where he's doing stuff, and he should be there because you're just putting him in because it's not Deep Space Nine without him. So he should be there all the time. In my head, he is.
I can't wait till the Blu-ray release of Deep Space Nine, where we get the special extended cut of every episode. And it's going to be Una's cut of each episode with 12 extra minutes of Garrick footage.
Garrick telling you what he thinks about. Yeah, exactly that. God, wouldn't that be fantastic? That's like a dream come true.
Well, and that's something that in that episode, I really feel like it would have been a great place to have a scene where, you know, Garrick and Bashir talk about that, because it would have really wrapped that kind of their relationship up. You know, Garrick being like, you were just messing with me the whole time now, yeah, weren't you? And Garrick having to realize that this doctor was a lot smarter from the beginning than he realized. I wish that they had gotten that scene in that episode, because it would have been really good.
I really missed that scene. I mean, Garrick must have been furious when he found out, you know, how have you pulled this past me for 4 years or whatever it is? And, you know, you looked so innocent. You looked so like butter wouldn't melt in your mouth. And basically, you're a better liar than I am. It just adds to my theory. I'm convinced that Bashir is going to end up like Garrick one day, that he will, you know, he will end up. We see him on that path already, but he's got everything in place. Garrick must have been furious about this. I mean, he does jibe him about the genetic enhancements, doesn't he? He kind of needles him about it, doesn't he? So you can mm-hmm. see how cross he was. And yeah, I really missed that scene. I think that would have been absolute gold. And they would have played it brilliantly. Both of them would have really enjoyed that. So yeah, I could have sat through that. I really want this extended edition now. I'm going to be gutted.
You got to get CBS in touch with you so you can get to work on that. And
dear CBS, I demand, I require.
As long as you'll also put in the Andorian fight scenes that we've also been missing for all these years, that would
I'll
be
leave
fantastic
that to someone
too.
Else. That someone else can take that gig.
Well, Jeffrey Combs can handle that for us.
That's true. He's everywhere.
Yeah.
Well, one of the more intriguing turns, I guess, in relationships is him and Captain Sisko. And of course, the episode that comes to mind first is In the Pale Moonlight, and how we see a Starfleet captain kind of getting his view of events kind of getting twisted up with this unique way that Garrick sees things and the influence Garrick has on Sisko. You have to, as a sociologist, really be intrigued by what happened in that episode.
Yeah, I think it actually brings out the more of the psychologist in me, actually. I'm convinced that Garrick has been plotting revenge since the episode Second Skin. It's a third season episode where Sisko blackmails him to go back to Cardassia Prime. Garrick is clearly furious about this, and I'm pretty certain he's been plotting a fairly unpleasant revenge on Sisko since then. And I think that this is the revenge that he eventually manages to play on Sisko. Yeah, I love that episode. I think it's really challenging. I think it's really bold of them to do it, because it's so not Trek. And I know it makes a lot of people feel very uncomfortable. They feel that it doesn't sit with the ethics or the vision of the show. I think it's pretty bold. I don't think we're asked necessarily to think that Garrick is doing the right thing. I don't think we should fall for the way that Garrick is manipulating Sisko. And he really does play Sisko like a fiddle. I mean, you know, it's clear that he knows what he has to do from the start of that episode. And step by step, he just takes Sisko there with him and persuade Sisko that what he's doing is the right thing. It's a pretty nasty revenge, I think, that Garrick gets on Sisko in that episode. Of course, Sisko gets to punch him, but that's probably not... everybody gets to punch Garrick. I love that episode. I don't think we're meant to think that Garrick is the good guy or that what Garrick does is justified. I think we're meant to feel really uncomfortable about it. Mm. That's my reading.
That's an interesting angle. I don't know if I've ever thought of it from that angle of him plotting a revenge on Sisko. I'm going to go and follow that thread back through now.
I just like these. I like making up these very long stories in my head. This is my all my extended edition in my head, you see. And you look for this continuity. I mean, I wonder if the writers put it in, because you're making a program very quickly. But when you watch a show in the way that, you know, we watch a show, you watch it back and back and back, I think you can't help but sort of string these long narratives together and make sense out of them. But I think there's something brewing between those two from pretty early on. And I think Garrick enjoys what he gets to do to Sisko. Also, Sisko can be so self-righteous. It must really, really irritate Garrick. And, he gets his pound of flesh in that episode, I think, and really, really gets Sisko there. And where Sisko, where it will hurt, I think Sisko does not like to think of himself as compromised. He's the emissary, you know? He's the good guys. And he's an accessory to murder by the end of that episode. Yeah, it's great. It's wonderful.
One of the things that I was thinking about today when I was thinking about that episode and Sisko and his relationship with Garrick and what happens, and I realized I think that this is the dark side of the utilitarian axiom, the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few or the one. And when you take that to its logical conclusion in this episode, it's logical for the Romulan to die, for billions to live. And so when Garrick says it only cost the life of one Romulan senator and the self-respect of one Starfleet officer, and is that too much for the price of billions and billions of lives? And I liked that Trek would explore this very dark side of something that we've always taken to be so good. You know, I mean, it comes from Spock, and so we think of it as being, you know, holy almost. And yet, honestly, utilitarian logic can be warped into some very horrible things. And you're left with that struggle then that Sisko has of the morality that he still feels. This may have been right in some ways, but it's also wrong in some ways too. And I'm just going to have to live with it. And I think, you know, when we look at that episode, those two guys, their performances are just the standouts of the entire series, I think. Because I don't think that anybody gives a better performance in any episode than those two guys in that episode.
Yeah, they really do it. I'll also put a word in for the guy who plays Graython Tola, the Forger. He's one of my favorite minor characters in Trek. It's just a brilliant little cameo. This sort of weird comedy that's going on in the middle of this, and then you know he's a really, really creepy guy, it turns out, as well. So everything in that episode is unsettling in some way. Garrick forgets to mention the four bodyguards that he's killed as well.
That's true.
The senator has four bodyguards with him, so it's actually five people that get killed, but still, you weigh that against billions. And you're absolutely right that Sisko can't really see clearly which was right and which was wrong. He, at the end of that episode, he's still confused about the morality of what's happened, and half of him says yes and half of him says no. That's what makes it so brilliant, I think. That's why we're talking about it and why people get really exercised about it, and why it feels so not Trek in many ways, and yet Trek.
Yeah, I think it feels not Trek to a lot of people, but it feels very Deep Space Nine to me.
Yeah, I guess, that's a good point. Yeah,
I mean, in some ways, Deep Space Nine, it is the outlier in Trek, but it's also, as we talk about in here often, the most realistic portrayal of life in Star Trek. And a lot of people hate that episode because they cannot stand the idea that a Starfleet captain could do anything like that or be compromised or be involved in some sort of nefarious activity, even when it actually is for the benefit of the greater good and the Alpha Quadrant. But I don't know. I love that episode because it shows Sisko as a real man, a real person, and struggling with the things that you always have to struggle with.
Well, and the other logic that you can go with too is that there's a good chance that if they don't do this, those Romulans are going to be dead anyway. That's not the best logic, but it's true that the Alpha Quadrant will be run over by the Dominion if they don't band together, all of them, at one time. And so, plus, I really like Senator Vrenak in the episode because it gives us the best internet meme ever. It's a fake!
It's a fake! It's a cake! Yeah, I was just thinking about that as well. Absolutely brilliant.
You know, Garrick, he was posing as a gardener at the Cardassian embassy on Romulus. It's a rake! You can do so much with Vrenak.
Endless, isn't it? This episode really is the gift that keeps on giving, I think.
Oh, man. What character, I don't know, I'm sure that, Una, you have the whole narrative in your mind of the relationship. Garrick and Ducat, what do you see in that interplay between those two characters that maybe isn't on the screen?
They clearly can't stand each other. I think it's difficult to have a good working relationship when you've had somebody's father tortured and killed. That's going to be a tricky one to come back from. I'm sorry we don't hear more about that. We don't really learn more about that. It's a bit of a throwaway line, and we don't really get it explored. I kind of like the there's a great deal of. There's so much aggression and mutual contempt. And you kind of sympathise with Ducat's contempt for Garrick in many ways. You kind of think, well, you know, at the end of the day, Garrick is a bit of a shifty character. He's not very trustworthy. He lies. He does very bad things. You can see Ducat's distaste. I think it's like the kind of distaste that branches of the armed forces must have for the spies. You know, we fight good fights and they fight dirty fights. So I can sort of see Ducat deluding himself with that. And then really, Garrick's masterstroke is to get Zial to fall in love with him. That really is just really just throwing it in Ducat's face. It's clearly an uncomfortable relationship. I'm not sure we quite get it teased out, particularly that backstory between them. But when it comes to the tension over Zial, that I think is very well played.
Yeah, I love that relationship too, and I really like when Garrick is lamenting not killing Ducat when he had the chance. And we all feel that too, because if he had, so much wouldn't have happened. I like that that's a question that this show has to answer. Wow, what if Garrick had just, you know, shot Ducat in the back? Garrick might not have lived either, but then the Alpha Quadrant would have also probably been a lot safer.
It would, although I think a lot of the Dominion's antipathy to the Alpha Quadrants comes from the fact that the Obsidian Order and the Tal Shiar launched this attack on them. So Garrick is in many ways culpable for this war that we see unfolding. It's a tragedy that, you know, the price is so high. I mean, he pays the absolute price. He pays the price of Cardassia. There's a lot of blood on Garrick's hands in that respect as well. I love that scene in Way of the Warrior where they're standing next to each other and kind of, you know, eyeing the other guy up. Is he going to kill me? Am I going to kill him? No, we've got to kill the bad guys. That's a great scene. Yeah, very, very well played.
Una, what are some of the things that with Bashir and Garrick, what do you see some of the ways that they both sharpen each other and really kind of challenge each other?
I think that Bashir can genuinely hold his own in conversation with Garrick, although he's a little uncertain at first. By the end, by the time that, you know, the secrets of the genetic enhancements is out and Bashir isn't having to kind of conceal how brilliant he is, they are clearly a match for each other when it comes to verbal repartee. I think Bashir really is a lifeline for Garrick in the early days of his exile. You know, he's good company, he's easy on the eye, he makes Garrick feel better about himself. Garrick's able to play sophistication, worldly wise, older man. Bashir's playing the ingenue. I think this is a really important relationship for Garrick, who must be pretty, you know, I've been chucked out of my home, I'm stuck on this dreadful place, my enemies are now in charge, I can't get away. At least there's somebody decorative and interesting to talk to every once a week at lunch. So I think Bashir is crucial for Garrick, and we see how much Garrick has come to rely on him by the time we get to The Wire, that he wouldn't have got through that without Bashir. It's a very revealing episode. So, you know, Bashir's really significant. And then by the end, it's a shame that we don't see as much of them together by the end of the show, but the little glimpses that we get, the sparring is still there, the warmth is still there. I would have liked to have seen more of that.
Yeah, I really like their relationship and the fact that I really just kind of see, you know, Garrick kind of thinks he's going to take this naive young man and kind of turn him into something. And in some ways that happens for Bashir. He goes from being somebody who's a little rambunctious and a little bit overeager in everything to somebody who becomes just a little bit more skeptical and a little bit more thoughtful and just really a little bit more discerning in what he does, how he acts, what he thinks about things. And he's a lot more pragmatic, I think, by the end from hanging out with Garrick. And on the other side, I think really when you look at how Garrick changes, I think the acceptance that he gets from Dr. Bashir, always being there for him, willing to talk, have lunch, really does something for Garrick in a way that opens him up and begins to allow him to trust other people in a way that he hasn't before. Because Bashir always stays true to that friendship and never turns his back on him or anything like that. And again, for a person like Garrick, this is going to be something that's unheard of. And that kind of nice guy bit that Bashir has really does a number, I think, on Garrick in the end.
Yeah, I agree. I think the whole experience of Deep Space Nine, of living on Deep Space Nine and having two or three, maybe four people just being decent and nice to Garrick really comes as a shock to him. He's not really got the the wherewithal to cope with it. But Bashir is consistently decent. Zial loves him. Jadzia, I can see getting on pretty well with him. We don't really see much of them together. And even Quark, in his own way, there's clearly a kind of they clearly respect each other on some level. There's a kind of transparency to the relationships that I think is transformative for Garrick. Gosh, I didn't know that we could just, you know, be straightforward with each other and decent and quite good friends. And this is a new thing for him and really changes him. Yeah, I'd agree.
Well, we've talked about, especially in depth, Zial, Bashir, Sisko, Dukat a little bit. And now you mentioned Quark, Jadzia, and a few others. Are there any other, while we're still on the topic of characters, are there any other relationships or individual instances in particular episodes and stories that stand out to you as being turning points or key to Garrick's character development?
I love where the relationship with Kira goes. I think that's fantastic. And it's such a late gift of the show in the way that, you know, you see the hostility between them from so early on and quite understandable on Kira's part. No wonder she hates this man, particularly when she discovers he's Obsidian Order. And yet by the end, they're the last two standing on Cardassia Prime pretty much, aren't they? It's just the two of them. Odo is sick. Damar is killed. And there's just the two of them. It's wonderful where that relationship goes. Tacking into the Wind is one of my favourite episodes of Deep Space Nine. And it's where we have the five of them, isn't it? It's Kira, Damar, Odo, Garrick and Rassot. And you see all those loyalties are so complex and the tensions between them are so complex. And yet Kira and Garrick are kind of that you can see how much they've come to depend on each other by that point. They really can rely on the others to back them up. I love where that story ends. I think that's transformative for Garrick and for Kira and for Cardassia and Bajor. It's a really important part of the story of Deep Space Nine. Again, I wish, you know, I could have a whole spin-off series of Cardassian Underground, you know, just the all of them in that bunker having adventures. I could deal with 13 episodes of that and watch that quite happily. I love where the relationship with Kira goes. Really don't see much of it, but what you see is absolute gold, I think.
That sounds like a good book series for you to put together there, the Cardassian Underground.
Now there's a thought. Yeah, I like that. I like your thinking.
Well, you mentioned that Kira and Garrick are the last two standing. And so there's always that question of whether Garrick is a traitor or a patriot. And what's your reading of him? Where does he end up in the end?
Oh, I think he ends up as patriot. I think he's closer to traitor earlier in his career. when he's doing these things which he thinks are for Cardassia, but are actually much, much more to secure Tane's respect and love. So things like joining in the attack on the Founder's homeworld is a disaster for Cardassia. It destroys Cardassia, and Garak is culpable. So it's almost as if he's a traitor earlier on, certainly a patriot by the end, and my sense is that going forward, it's a different kind of Cardassia that Garak wants. So traitor to patriots would be my reading. It's not the way Garak feels it, but I think it's how it is.
Right. He does things that lead to the destruction of Cardassia as it was known. So in a sense, a traitor. But in the end, he is, in a sense, a savior of Cardassia, at least to help it move forward into its new existence.
Yes, I agree.
In the end, in the show, you know, he's lost everyone that was close to him or meant something to him, really. You know, Tane, Mila, Zial, and the Cardassia that he knew. It's all gone. And I feel that weight of the end of the show for Garak is that they're both reborn, Cardassia and Garak. Much like the Phoenix, they've both been burned down to the ground, and now they'll have to rise up again and become something new. And you know that Garak is a changed man. He is no longer the manipulator and the liar and all of those things. I feel that what he is a man who found principle and honor and the desire to make his home world something beautiful and something that people look to again, you know, because he talks so fondly about what Cardassia has given to the galaxy and its literature, its music, its arts, all of these things. And I think this is what he wants Cardassia to be known for again. And I think he wants himself to be known as somebody worthy of being looked up to, you know, not a spy or a traitor or somebody willing to do anything to get power. He wants it for his people. And I really love that arc because it's very powerful. And again, you know, we talked about he's in 30 episodes, I think you said, Una.
And something like that. And some of those are alternate universe ones as well. So yeah, right. Something like 30-odd. Yeah.
Yeah, it's 33, actually, is the exact count.
Okay. For that to happen in 33 episodes, that kind of character development and growth is amazing.
Yeah, I know. It's really epic at the end, really elegiac. And I think he feels the death of Damar very much as well. I know that's partly me reading in my shock at the death of Damar. I couldn't believe they did that. Sort of in the last, you know, the last 15 minutes of this this plot line, they just kill off the guy that you're going, oh, he's clearly the hope for the new Cardassia. Oh, no, he's not. Good storytelling, really shocking. And I think that's a great blow to Garak as well, that he's kind of fixed on this figure as someone who he can see has gone from the murder of Zial through a painful process of realizing what he's done and wanting to make amends for it. And I think that's probably encourages that same kind of shift in Garak as well. Well, if Damar isn't there now to do this, it's going to have to fall on those of us who are still alive. Yeah, I don't know if we end on a note of... I don't know if in the show we end on a note of hope for Cardassia. I feel that parting is very bleak with Bashir. But yeah, I do kind of sense that the only way out for Cardassia now, it's either complete annihilation or it's regeneration and a complete change. And I'm hopeful for it, yeah.
They certainly left you with plenty to work with in writing novels.
They did. Yes, thank goodness. They did indeed.
One thing I wanted to ask you beyond the television show and related to Garak is you've written a number of Star Trek stories and novels. And when you think about Garak as you're writing him, in your mind, how do you see this character continuing to evolve past what we see and what you leave behind?
I guess I touch a little on this. We see a little of him in my novella, The Lotus Flower, where we see him as he's working for Alan Gamore, who's the current head of the Cardassian Union. So again, he's found somebody that he can be the loyal lieutenant to. I think Garak does cast himself in that role. You know, he's Tane's lieutenant, then he's Damar's lieutenant, and then he finds himself as Gamor's lieutenant. And I like their working relationship. They've known each other for a long time. They've got Gamor is quite an extroverted figure that seems comfortable being the face of government, and Garak is behind the scenes. And then I think we sort of the last that we have him is as ambassador to the Federation, and that struck me as a very natural role for Garak. I think on some level he's fallen in love with the Federation. It intrigues him. It fascinates him. He recognises that his time amongst these people has changed him in certain ways, and he's curious to learn more. I think he wants some of what the Federation has for Cardassia, and maybe that's why he's there for so long. And also, he would be a great ambassador. He'd love the intrigue. He'd love the parties. He'd love the dressing up. It's a job that would just suit him down to the ground, I think. So that's where we've left him, but always, I think, striving for a changed Cardassia, a Cardassia that is improved in some way for the sake of the Cardassian people, if nothing else. So that's where it's gone in the books. And then I have a new book coming out at the end of the year, but I'm not going to say anything about that. So you'll have to read that one. Garak is in it, though. He's quite a significant character in it, with Picard. So there's a nice little double act going on there. Yeah.
I can't wait.
That will be very interesting.
I hope you're going to enjoy it. I've just got the copy edits through, so I'm working with it again at the moment. So, but I can't say anything more. So.
Well, when it comes out, you'll have to come and join us on Literary Treks and talk about that.
I'd be happy to do that. Yeah, it's part of this long series, so ideally we'll get all the gang in. That'd be fantastic. Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight, Una. It's been a pleasure to have you on The Orb to talk about Garak and just what an amazing character. But as we always do, please let everyone know where they can follow you and find you, and what are some of your latest things that that they can go out and look for as well. We'd like to let all the listeners know about that.
Right, so you can find me on Twitter. That's where I'm busiest these days, and that's at Una McCormack. So very easy to find. I've been a bit quiet recently because I've been teaching. That's been keeping me quite busy. But I've just had an audio play come out from a company called Big Finish, who do Doctor Who audios and Doctor Who spin-offs. And I have an audio play out from them in a series called Gallifrey, which is a Doctor Who spin-off. So people can go and listen to that if they're interested. And I have another audio coming from them later in the year, which is based on one of my favourite TV shows, which is Blake 7, which is a dodgy 1970s BBC science fiction show. So that's what's lined up for this year. And then, of course, my Garak and Picard novel, The Crimson Shadow, and that's out in October, I think. So Twitter is the place to find me. That's mostly where I am now, mostly complaining about the fact that it's snowing in Britain and that the weather's terrible.
Excellent. Well, I really appreciate you taking some time in your late night there in England and the wee hours of the morning to talk about our favorite Taylor.
Oh, it's great. It's like being a student again. I could have, you know, when I was about 19, I could have sat up all night just talking about my favorite TV show. So, it's about 1 o'clock here now. So it's not too late. I kind of unwind and go to bed. But no, what a great thing to do. Stay up late talking about Garak. Perfectly happy to do it. Really enjoyed it. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Una.
And Matthew, let's tell everyone where to find us as well. If they'd like to share their thoughts on Garak or what we've talked about today, you can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Orb, and that will come right to us. You can also join us in our forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section for the Orb. There's one for Deep Space Nine. And you can talk about this show, Garak in general, or anything you want to talk about Deep Space Nine with other listeners. And you'll find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm. And Matthew, what if people want to find you personally?
Well, Chris, you can find me at MattRushing02 on Twitter. So please do give me an at reply. Let me know you're following me. We'll talk about Star Trek and all sorts of different things, whatever flights of fancy you might be having that day, as well as doing literary treks with you where we get to talk to such authors as Una McCormick or James Swallow, David Mack. And so please join us there as well. Chris, where can we find you on the interwebs?
Well, of course, you can find me on Literary Treks, as you just mentioned. You can also find me on Twitter under username C. Brian Jones. That's Brian with a Y. And you can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that same username. You can also find me elsewhere here on the network on The Ready Room each week, where we talk about all the series, sometimes serious discussions like we had here today, and often a lot of humor as well. It's a good mix, and sometimes, Matthew, you're there with me, sometimes Char, and a whole other cast of Trek FM hosts and special guests like Larry Nemechek and many others from the Star Trek world. So you can find that at trek.fm/TRR, in iTunes, on Stitcher. You can find all of our other shows in those places as well. So check us out there.
Well, thank you all for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the orb.